Hello, and welcome to The Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record as part of The Learning College at vnnforum.com. I also post links at pivotal.net and kirksvilletoday.com, a daily digest from the White point of view. Today we're going to conclude Chapter 10 of Hitler's Mein Kampf, the Thomas Dalton translation. In this last set of segments, which is 10.25 to 10.34, Dalton created these subsections. Hitler is going to talk about religion, and he's also going to talk about the state, army, civil service, navy, and do more inveighing against half measures. He's very much against half measures. Do something all the way or don't do it. So this will cover, let's see, about roughly 270 to 290. Roughly. All right, so let's look it up and get to it. All right, so well, begin on page 274, and this will be a little bit shorter, probably about 13, 14 pages, somewhere in there. 274, 1025, religious conditions. All these symptoms of decay must be attributed to the lack of a definite and uniformly accepted worldview. He's talking about degeneration from art last time, spiritual degeneration he's heading into now, and of physical degeneration of syphilis last recording. This is recording 14 we're on now. All these symptoms of decay must be attributed to the lack of a definite and uniformly accepted worldview. They have to all the people have to be on the same page. He said a state is formed, a nation is formed of people who think and feel the same way about stuff. And subsequent general uncertainty of attitude toward the great questions of the time. This accounts for the habit of doing everything halfway. The habit of doing everything halfway, beginning with the educational system. And he said last time, it's focused on filling people with so-called wisdom and not on training their body as well at the same time. And he's like, you got to do both of them and their character, work in their character and strengthen their will. He's very big on all those things. Character, will, body, and mind. You can only have a sound mind in a sound body. And that's from the Greeks, of course. This accounts for the habit of doing everything halfway, beginning with the educational system, the reluctance to undertake responsibilities. Again, he talked about early marriage last time and the need to remove obstacles to it, which is tied up with the need for more living space. The cowardly tolerance of recognized abuses. Humanitarian garbage became the fashion. And in weakly submitting to these aberrations and sparing individual feelings, the future of millions was sacrificed. His thought is always for the whole, not for any one person. An examination of the religious situation before the war shows that the general process of disintegration was growing. The religious situation before the war. A large part of the nation itself had, for a long time already, ceased to have any convictions of a uniform and effective worldview. In this, again, that's the German word, Weltanschauung. In this matter, the main point was by no means the number of people who renounced their church membership, but rather the widespread indifference. While both Christian denominations, that'd be Catholicism and Lutheranism, maintain missions in Africa and Asia in order to win new followers with only modest success compared to the growth of Islam, these same denominations were losing millions and millions of adherents at home in Europe. These former adherents either gave up all religion or adopted their own interpretation. The consequences, particularly in morality, are not good. It must be noted, too, that the attack on the dogmatic foundations of the various churches became increasingly violent. And yet our world would be inconceivable without the practical existence of a religious faith. Now, I don't agree with that, but now is not the time to go into it. The great masses of a nation are not philosophers. For the masses of people, faith is the only basis of morality. The various substitutes that have been offered haven't shown any results that would justify replacing existing faiths. But if religious teaching and faith are accepted by the masses, then the absolute authority of religious doctrines would be the foundation of all practical effort. There may be a few hundred thousand superior men who can live wisely and intelligently without depending on social norms, but millions of others cannot. That, I think, is probably true. For them, the role of social norms corresponds to everyday life in the same way that laws relate to the state and dogma to religion. I think all you need is strong punishment, and that will activate their fear and keep them in line. Not fear of God has never restrained anybody from doing what he wanted, I believe, personally. The purely intellectual idea is, of itself, a variable thing that is subject to endless interpretations. It's only through dogma that it has a precise and concrete form, without which religion couldn't become a living faith. Otherwise, the intellectual idea would never become anything more than a mere metaphysical concept, or rather, a philosophical opinion. The attack against dogma is comparable to an attack against the general laws on which the state is founded. Such a political attack would lead, in the end, to a complete political anarchy if it were successful. In the same way, an attack on dogma would lead to a worthless religious nihilism. A political leader shouldn't estimate the value of religion by taking its shortcomings into account, but rather by virtue of a demonstrably better substitute. Until such a substitute is available, only fools or criminals would think of abolishing that which exists. Well, count me in the fool category, because I think the fact that it's untrue is a justification for getting rid of it. And when you purely look at the functional bit, and you can believe he didn't believe in Jesus at all. If you're going to teach people to believe in falsehoods, you're going to destroy a lot of otherwise good people. Undoubtedly, no small amount of blame for the present unsatisfactory religious situation must be attributed to those who have encumbered the religious ideal with purely material accessories. This gave rise to an utterly futile conflict between religion and so-called exact science. In this conflict, victory will nearly always be on the side of science, though perhaps after a hard struggle, and religion will thus suffer heavily in the eyes of those who can't penetrate beyond mere superficial knowledge. You got to remember also, I'm free to speak whatever the truth is. He is someone who has to appeal for votes to people. So in the end, he's also a Democratic politician and will lie. And if you think he's going to denounce Christianity in a book that's going to be printed in the millions, second maybe only to the Bible in Germany, not very likely. So I believe Hitler was not a Christian. His belief in nature, and it's not a matter of belief, what he says about nature, it's still a remove from denouncing Christianity, but it's 180 degrees from the beliefs that Christianity promulgates. So he's essentially saying, look at religion functionally, which is another view I don't agree with. 1026, political misuse of religion. But the greatest damage of all has come from the misuse of religion as a means to serve political ends or political interests. The misuse of religion as a means to serve political interests. In truth, we can't attack hard enough those wretched criminals who would prefer to make religion provide political, or rather business, services for them. The impudent liars who do this profess their faith before the whole world in stentorian tones, that means very large, loud and powerful from Greek myth, so that all sinners may hear, not that they are ready to die for it, but rather that they may live all the better. They are ready to sell their faith for a single political swindle. For 10 parliamentary mandates, they would ally themselves with the Marxists, who are the mortal foes of all religion. And for a seat in the cabinet, they would enter into a marriage with the devil, if the latter hadn't still retained some traces of decency. That's about as close as Hitler will ever come to humor in this book. If religious life in pre-war Germany left a bad taste in many mouths, it was because Christianity was abused by a so-called Christian party. They shamelessly attempted to identify the Catholic faith with a political party, the Catholic Center Party. This false association was a disaster. It procured some worthless parliamentary mandates for a bunch of good-for-nothings, but the church suffered damage. The consequences of that situation had to be borne by the whole nation. The slackening of religious life occurred at a point when everything was beginning to waver and vacillate, and the traditional foundations of ethics and of morality were threatening to collapse. Even then, all those cracks and rifts in the national body might not have been dangerous if no grave burdens arose. But they became disastrous when the internal solidarity of the nation was the most decisive factor in withstanding the storm of events. 1027. Aimlessness of German policy. In the political field also, observant eyes might have noticed certain evils of the Reich that foretold disaster, unless some change and correction took place in time. The lack of orientation in German policy, both domestic and foreign, was obvious to everyone who was not purposely blind. The best thing that can be said about the business of compromise is that it seems to be in harmony with Bismarck's axiom that politics is the art of the possible. But there was a small but crucial difference between Bismarck and the later German chancellors. This difference allowed the former to apply that formula to the very essence of his policy, while in the mouths of the others it took on an utterly different meaning. When he uttered that phrase, Bismarck meant to say that, in order to attain a definite political end, all possible means should be employed, or at least taken into account. But his successors saw in that phrase only a solemn declaration that one need not be bound to any political goals or ideas at all. And the political leaders of the Reich at that time had no far-seeing policy. Here again, the necessary foundation was lacking, namely, a definite worldview. And they also lacked the clear insight into the laws of political development that is a necessary quality in political leadership. Many who took a gloomy view of things at that time condemned the lack of ideas and orientation that were evident in the policy of the Reich. They recognized the inner weakness and futility of this policy. But such people played only a secondary role in politics. The official government authorities were quite indifferent to such principles of civil wisdom as those of Houston Stuart Chamberlain. Footnote 10, our current leaders still do the same. Footnote 10 reads, Chamberlain, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, 1855 to 1927, was born in England but spent the majority of his adult life in Germany. He was a prominent intellectual of the day. His best-known work, Foundations of the 19th Century, was highly influential to Hitler. These people are too stupid to think for themselves. They are too conceited to learn from others, a fact that confirms Oxenstierna's saying, the world is governed by a mere fraction of wisdom. Footnote 11. Axel Oxenstierna, Stierna, 1583 to 1654, was prime minister of Sweden, but the saying seems to be apocryphal. And indeed, nearly every civil servant embodies only an atom of this fraction. But since Germany became a republic, even this modicum is lacking. That's why they had to pass the Law for the Defense of the Republic, which prohibits expressing such views or even thinking them. Oxenstierna was lucky to live when he did and not in our wise republic. 1028, parliamentary half measures. He's very against half measures, as we know, in the war against syphilis or anything else. Parliamentary half measures, 1028. Even before the war, the institution that should have represented the strength of the Reich was recognized by many as its greatest weakness, the Parliament, the Reichstag. Here, cowardice and irresponsibility were completely unified. Cowardice and irresponsibility, that's what he basically sees as the problem with parliamentarianism in general. One of the most foolish ideas that one hears today is that, in Germany, the parliamentary institution has gone wrong since the revolution. This too easily implies that the case was different before the revolution, but in reality its effect was highly destructive, and this was true even in those days when people saw nothing or didn't wish to see anything. The German downfall can be attributed, in no small degree, to this institution. But that the catastrophe didn't take place sooner is not to be credited to the Parliament, but rather to those who opposed the influence of this institution, which, during peace times, was digging the grave of the German nation from the German Reich. Digging the grave, the Reichstag, from the immense number of devastating evils that were due either directly or indirectly to the Parliament. I'll pick one of the most typical of this institution that was the most irresponsible of all time, the terrible half-heartedness and weakness of the political leaders in conducting the internal and external affairs of the Reich. This was primarily attributable to the action of the Reichstag and was one of the principal causes of the political collapse. Everything subject to the influence of Parliament was done in half measures, no matter how you look at it. The foreign policy of the Reich in the matter of alliances was an example of such half-heartedness. They wanted to maintain peace, but in doing so, they steered straight into war. Their Polish policy was also carried out by half measures. One merely irritated without ever finishing anything. It resulted neither in a German triumph nor Polish conciliation, and it made enemies of the Russians. They tried to solve the Alsace-Lorraine question through half measures. Instead of crushing the French Hydra's head, once and for all, with a brutal fist, and then granting Alsace-Lorraine equal rights, they did neither. Nor could they have done otherwise, for the biggest parties had among their ranks the biggest traitors. In the center party, for example, Mr. Wetterli, footnote 12, Emile Wetterli, Wetterle, with an accent on the E, 1861 to 1931, was a French Catholic politician who founded the Alsatian Nationalist Party in 1910. N29, Parliamentary Crimes Against the Army. But all this would have been bearable if the half-heartedness hadn't extended to the one power that was ultimately responsible for the survival of the Reich, the army. The sins committed by the so-called German Reichstag were sufficient to draw down upon it the curses of the German nation for all time. On the most miserable of pretexts, these parliamentary henchmen filched from the hands of the nation its weapon of self-defense, the only thing protecting the liberty and independence of our people. If the graves of Flanders were to open today, blood-stained accusers would arise, hundreds of thousands of our best German youth who, poorly or half-trained, were driven into the arms of death by those conscienceless parliamentary criminals. Those youths, and millions of others of dead and mutilated, were lost to the fatherland simply and solely in order that a few hundred deceivers of the people might carry out their political swindles and blackmail, or merely rattle off their doctrinaire theories. While the Jews and their Marxist and democratic press spread the colossal falsehood about German militarism throughout the world and tried to incriminate Germany by every possible means, at the same time, the Marxist and democratic parties obstructed measures that were necessary for the adequate training of our national defenses. The appalling crime thus committed by these people ought to have been obvious to everyone who could see that, in the case of war, the whole nation would be called to arms. Furthermore, because of the huckstering of these so-called representatives of the people, millions of Germans would have to face the enemy ill-equipped and insufficiently trained. But even apart from the consequences of the brutal unscrupulousness of these parliamentarian scoundrels, it was quite clear that the lack of properly trained soldiers in the beginning of a war would likely lead to defeat. And this probability was confirmed in a most terrible way during the course of the war. The German people lost the struggle for the freedom and independence of their country because of the half-hearted and defective policy employed during peacetime in the organization and training of the defensive strength of the fatherland. 1030, the failed naval policy. The number of recruits trained for the land forces was too small. But the same half-heartedness was shown in regard to the Navy, and it made this weapon of national self-preservation more or less worthless. Unfortunately, even the naval authorities themselves were infected with this spirit of half-heartedness. The tendency to build all ships somewhat smaller than the British didn't show much foresight and less genius. A fleet that can't achieve the same numerical strength as the enemy should compensate by the superior fighting power of the individual ship. It's superior fighting power that counts, and not any sort of traditional quality. As a matter of fact, modern technical development is so advanced and so well proportioned among the various civilized states that it must be looked on as practically impossible for one power to gain any appreciable fighting advantage over enemy ships of a similar size. And it's even less feasible to build ships of a smaller size that will be superior in action to those of larger ones. As a matter of fact, the smaller proportions of the German ships could be maintained only at the expense of speed and armament. The phrase used to justify this policy was in itself evidence of the lack of logical thinking on the part of the naval authorities who were in charge of these matters in peacetime. They declared, for example, that the 28-centimeter German guns were definitely superior to the British 30.5 centimeters in terms of performance. But that was just why they should have adopted a policy of building 30.5 centimeter guns as well. They should have aimed not for equality, but superiority in fighting strength. Otherwise, it would have been superfluous to equip the land forces with 42-centimeter mortars. The German 21-centimeter mortar was far superior to any high-angle French guns, and the fortresses could probably have been taken by means of 30.5-centimeter mortars. Army leadership calculated correctly. That of the Navy, unfortunately, did not. If they neglected superior artillery power and speed, it was because of their fundamentally false so-called principle of risk. The naval authorities, from the very beginning, renounced the principle of attack and thus had to follow a defensive policy. But by this attitude, they also renounced any chance of final success, which can only be achieved by attack. Final success can only be achieved by attack. A ship with slower speed and weaker armament will be crippled and battered. A ship that's slower and weaker will be crippled and battered by an adversary that is faster, stronger, and can shoot from a favorable distance. A large number of our cruisers have been through this bitter experience. The erroneous nature of prevailing ideas among naval authorities was proven during the war. They were compelled to modify the armaments of the old ships and to equip the new ones with better armaments. If the German vessels in the Battle of Skagerrak had been of equal size, equal armament, and equal speed as the English, the British fleet would have gone down under a tempest of the more accurate and more effective 38-centimeter German shells. Footnote 13, the Battle of Skagerrak, S-K-A-G-E-R-R-A-K, Skagerrak, also known as the Battle of Jutland, I'm not sure how it's pronounced. That's how it's more common in English, Jutland, J-U-T-L-A-N-D. That's a little part of Denmark, I believe. The Battle of Skagerrak, also known as the Battle of Jutland, occurred over 2 days in early June 1916. The German and British fleets fought to a draw. And he's saying if they had had the equal-sized ships, then their superior shells would have prevailed. Japan followed quite a different kind of naval policy. There, care was taken to create every single new vessel as a superior fighting force to that of the presumed adversaries, the Russians, for example. As a result of this policy, it was thereafter possible to use the fleet for offensives. While the army authorities refused to adopt such fundamentally erroneous principles, the Navy, which unfortunately had better parliamentary representation, succumbed to the spirit that ruled there. The Navy was organized on the basis of half-baked ideas and was later used in the same way. The immortal glory that the Navy won, in spite of these drawbacks, must be entirely credited to the good work, efficiency, and incomparable heroism of officers and crews. If the former commanders-in-chief had been inspired with the same level of genius, all sacrifices would not have been in vain. It was probably the very parliamentarian skill displayed by the naval chief during the years of peace that later caused the fatal collapse. Parliamentarian considerations had begun to play a more important role in the construction of the Navy than military ones. The half-heartedness, weakness, and failure to adopt a logically consistent policy, which is typical of the parliamentary system, began to color the naval authorities. As already emphasized, Army leadership didn't allow themselves to be led astray by such fundamentally erroneous ideas. Ludendorff, who was then a colonel in the general staff, led a desperate struggle against the criminal half-heartedness with which the Reichstag treated the most vital problems of the nation. In most cases, it voted against them. If the fight that this officer then waged remained unsuccessful, blame must be given in part to the Parliament, in part to the weak and miserable attitude of the Reich Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg. Footnote 14, Theobald von Bethmann Hollweg, hyphenated, Hollweg, 1856 to 1921, served as German Chancellor from 1909 to 1917. Yet those who are responsible for Germany's collapse don't hesitate now to lay all the blame on the shoulders of the one man who battled alone this neglect of national interests. One swindle, more or less, is nothing to these congenital tricksters. Anyone who thinks of all the sacrifices that this nation had to bear as a result of the criminal neglect of those irresponsible individuals, anyone who thinks of the number of those who died or were maimed unnecessarily, anyone who thinks of the boundless shame and dishonor that was heaped upon us, and of the immeasurable distress into which our people are now plunged, anyone who realizes that this was done simply to secure a few seats in Parliament for some unscrupulous job hunters and careerists, they will understand that such creatures can only be described by words such as scoundrel, villain, scum, and criminal. Otherwise, these words have no meaning. In comparison with these traitors to the nation, every pimp is an honorable man. Oddly enough, all the real faults of the old Germany were exposed to the public gaze only when it served to damage the inner solidarity of the nation. Yes, indeed, unpleasant truths were openly proclaimed in the ears of the broad masses, while many other things were, at other times, shamefully hushed up or their existence simply denied, especially at times when an open discussion of such problems might have led to an improvement. At the same time, higher government authorities knew little or nothing of the value and nature of propaganda. Only the Jew knew that by an able and persistent use of propaganda, heaven itself can be presented as hell, and vice versa, the most miserable kind of life as paradise. Only he knew this, the Jew, and acted accordingly. But the German, or rather his government, hadn't the slightest idea of this. During the war, we paid the heaviest of penalties for this ignorance. We talked about that before. § 10(31) German advantages. Alongside the innumerable evils that are mentioned here and which affected German life before the war, there were many advantages. If we take an impartial survey, we must admit that most of our weaknesses were shared with other countries and peoples, and very often in a worse form than with us. And they didn't possess many of our actual advantages. The foremost advantage was the fact that, alone among the European nations, the German nation made the strongest effort to preserve the national character of its economic structure. For this reason, it was less subject than others to control by international finance. And yet this was a dangerous advantage, one that later turned out to be the chief cause of the World War. Aside from this and many other positive features, we must single out three institutions that were constant sources of regeneration. In their respective spheres, they were models of perfection and were partly unrivaled. First, the state form as such, and the manner in which it was developed in modern Germany. Of course, we must accept those monarchs who, as human beings, were subject to the failings that afflict this earthly life and its children. If we weren't so tolerant in these matters, then the case of the present generation would be hopeless. If we take into consideration the personal capabilities and character of the representative figures in our present regime, it would be difficult to imagine a more modest level of intelligence and moral character. If we measure the value of the German Revolution by the personal worth and stature of the individuals whom this revolution has given the German people since November 1918, then we may feel truly ashamed at how posterity will pass judgment, given that protective laws can no longer silence public opinion. Posterity will surely say that the intelligence and integrity of our new German leaders were in adverse ratio to their boasting and their vices. Moving on to page 283. It must be admitted that the monarchy had become alien in spirit to many citizens, and especially the broad masses. This resulted from the fact that the monarchs were not always surrounded by the brightest minds, so to say, and certainly not always by the sincerest minds. Unfortunately, many of them preferred flatterers to plain-spoken men, and hence received their instruction from the former. This was a grave danger at a time when many of the world's old opinions were changing, and when this affected even the traditions of the court. The average man could not have felt any special enthusiasm when, for example, at the turn of the century, a princess in uniform rode at the front of a parade. Those in high circles apparently had no idea of the impression that this made on the minds of ordinary people, or it wouldn't have happened. Moreover, the sentimental humanitarianism, not always very sincere, that was professed in those high circles was often more repulsive than attractive. When, for instance, Princess X decided to taste the products of a soup kitchen and found them excellent, as usual, such a gesture might have made a good impression in times past, but now it had the opposite effect. Even if we take it for granted that Her Highness didn't have the slightest idea that, on the day she sampled it, the food was not quite the same as on other days, and he knows about this stuff because he was poor, remember. It sufficed that the people knew it. She becomes foolish. That's a Marie Antoinette type mistake. Even the best of intentions thus became an object of ridicule or a cause of exasperation. Stories of the monarch's proverbial frugality, his early rise in the morning, the drudgery he had to go through all day until long into the night, and especially the constant fear that he might become undernourished, all aroused dubious comments. No one was eager to know what and how much the monarch ate or drank. No one begrudged him a full meal or the necessary amount of sleep. Everyone was pleased when the monarch, as a man and a personality, brought honor in his family and his country and fulfilled his duties as a ruler. All the legends that were circulated about him helped little and, in fact, did much damage. These and such things, however, are only mere trifles. What was much worse was the feeling spread throughout large sections of the nation that the affairs of the individual were being taken care of from above and that he needn't bother himself with them. As long as the government was really good, or at least moved by goodwill, no serious objections could be raised. But woe to all if the old government of good intentions were replaced by a new one that was not so decent. Then the public's docile obedience and childlike faith were the most fatal of evils imaginable. But against these and other defects, there were many unquestionable assets. For one thing, the monarchical form guarantees stability in the entire state leadership and safeguards public offices from the speculative turmoil of ambitious politicians. Furthermore, the dignified tradition that this institution possesses gives weight to monarchical authority. Beyond this, there is the fact that the whole corps of officials, and the army in particular, are raised above the level of party obligations. And still another advantage was that the supreme rulership of the state was embodied in the monarch as an individual person, and whose example of personal responsibility was stronger than any anonymous parliamentary majority. Indeed, the proverbial integrity of the German administration must be attributed chiefly to this fact. Finally, the high cultural function of the monarch compensated for many of its defects. The German court cities have remained, even to our time, centers of an artistic spirit that now threatens to disappear in our materialistic age. The German princes did a great deal for art and science, especially during the 19th century. Our present age certainly has nothing to compare with it. The Army, an irreplaceable school. Army irreplaceable. During that process of disintegration that was slowly extending throughout the social order, the most positive force of resistance was the army. This was the strongest school of the German nation, and for that reason, the hatred of our enemies was directed against this buttress of national freedom and independence. The strongest testimony in favor of this unique institution is the fact that it was derided, hated, combated, and also feared by all inferior peoples. The fact that the international exploiters of our people, who gathered at Versailles, directed their enmity especially against the old German army, proved once again that it deserved to be regarded as the defender of our national freedom against the power of the stock exchange. Footnote 15. The Treaty of Versailles was signed in June 1919 after the end of World War I. It imposed onerous and impossible conditions upon Germany and falsely attributed full blame for the war to them. Without this warning, the intentions of Versailles would have long since been carried out. There is only one word to express what the German people owe to this army. Everything. It was the army that still promoted a sense of responsibility among the people when this quality was becoming very rare and when the habit of evading it was steadily spreading. This habit had grown up under the influences of Parliament, which was itself the very model of irresponsibility. The army trained the people to personal courage at a time when cowardice threatened to become an epidemic, when the spirit of sacrificing for the good of the community was considered as little more than stupidity, and when only those considered intelligent were the ones who promoted their own ego. The army was the school by which individual Germans were taught not to seek the salvation of their nation in the false ideology of international brotherhood between Negroes, Germans, Chinese, French, English, etc., but in the strength and unity of their own people. The army developed the individual's powers of resolve, and this at a time when the spirit of indecision and skepticism governed human affairs. In an age when the know-it-alls were everywhere and setting the fashion, it needed courage to uphold the principle that any command is better than none. This one principle represents a robust and sound style of thought, one that would have vanished had the army not furnished a constant renewal of this fundamental force. A sufficient proof of this may be found in the appalling lack of decision that our present Reich authorities display. They can't shake off their mental and moral lethargy and take definitive action, except when it comes to enforced decrees for exploiting the people. In that case, they decline all responsibility while at the same time they sign everything that the other side places before them with the agility of a court stenographer. In this case, the decision is easy to make. It's dictated to them. The army trained its men with a spirit of idealism and devotion to the fatherland, while greed and materialism dominated everywhere else. The army united a people who were divided into classes, and in this respect, it had only one defect, which was the voluntary one-year military service. It was a mistake because the principle of absolute equality was thereby violated. Those who had a better education were thus placed outside the setting of their general environment. The opposite would have been better. Since our upper classes were really ignorant of the corporate body of the nation and were becoming increasingly estranged from it, the army could have had a very positive effect if it had refused to segregate the so-called intellectuals, especially within its own ranks. It was a mistake that this wasn't done. But what institution in this world makes no mistakes? And in the army, the good features were so absolutely predominant that the few defects it had were far below the average that generally arise from human weakness. So, boy, this guy loves the army. But the greatest credit earned by the army was that, at a time when the individual person counted for nothing and the majority was everything, it placed individual personal values above majority values. Confronted with the Jewish democratic idea of a blind faith in numbers, the army defended its belief in personality. Thus, it trained that which was most needed at the time, real men. In a period when men were falling into a morass of effeminacy and softness, 350,000 vigorous young men were trained each year. 350,000. In the course of their 2 years' training, they lost the softness of their young days and developed bodies as tough as steel. The young man who had been taught obedience during this time was now ready to command. One could recognize the trained soldier by his very walk. This was the great school of the German nation, was the army. It was not without reason that it drew all the bitter hatred of those who wanted the Reich to be weak and defenseless. And remember, they found from studying that working out with weights and being physically fit, the more physically fit you are, the more right-wing your views, essentially. Right-wingism is tied to, nationalism is tied to physical fitness. Physical fitness and mental fitness go together. So left is literally mentally unfit. This was the great school of the German nation. It was not without reason that it drew all the bitter hatred of those who wanted the Reich to be weak and defenseless. The rest of the world recognized a fact that many Germans didn't wish to see, either due to blindness or ill will. The German army was the most powerful weapon for the freedom of the German nation and the best guarantee for the sustenance of its children. 1033, the incomparable civil service. There was a third institution of value that has to be placed beside the monarchy and the army. This was the civil service of the old Reich. So army, the king, the army, and the civil service are good, he's saying. Again, his father was a civil servant in Austria on the border with Germany. Germany was the best organized and best administered country in the world. There may have been objections to the bureaucratic red tape, but from this point of view, the other countries were no better and often worse. But the other states didn't have the wonderful German solidarity, nor were their civil servants of the same incorruptible honesty. It's certainly better to be a little old-fashioned but honest and loyal than to be over-sophisticated and modern with inferior character and thus typically ignorant and inefficient. If it be said today that the pre-war German administration was bureaucratically excellent but incompetent from a business point of view, I can only give the following reply. What other country in the world possessed a better organized and administered business enterprise than the German state railways? It was left to the revolution to destroy this exemplary organization. Remember, he says they sold it off to Jews in the stock market. Well, he basically equates the stock market with Jews, regardless of who specifically acquired it. Until a time came when it was taken out of the hands of the nation and socialized in the sense of the Republic's founders. This made it subservient to the International Stock Exchange, who were the power behind the German Revolution, the financial Jews. The most outstanding trait of the civil service and entire administrative apparatus was their independence from the government, whose passing views had no effect on the role of German state officials. Since the revolution, this situation has been completely changed. Efficiency and capability have been replaced by party ties, and independence of character and initiative are more of a hindrance than a help. So it's become a partisan thing. You reward your followers and give them administration of this that could have been neutral, professional, and non-political. Last section of the chapter and for this session, 14. 1034, state authority. The wonderful might and power of the old Reich was based on the monarchical state form, the army, and the civil service. The wonderful, everything good about the Reich was due to the army, the monarchy, and the civil service. On these three foundations, the monarchy, the army, and the civil service, incorruptible, honest, and very effective, right? Army, monarchy, civil service. On these three foundations rested that great strength that's now entirely lacking, state authority. For this cannot be based on the babbling that goes on in Parliament or in the provincial diets, little mini legislatures, or upon laws made to protect the state, or upon sentences passed by the law courts to frighten those insolently deny it, but only on the general confidence placed in the leadership and administration of the community. This confidence is, in its turn, nothing else than an unshakable inner conviction that the government and administration of a country is inspired by selflessness and honesty. And on, imagine thinking of that. I'm reading this at the time of the Biden administration. I mean, there's no one in Congress who's not a whore. Wouldn't lie about anything. He's saying the state authority can only ultimately really come from the people believing in the unshakable inner conviction that the government and administration of a country is inspired by selflessness and honesty and on agreement between the spirit of the law and the general moral convictions of the people. In the long run, systems of government are not maintained by threats of violence, but on the belief of the people in the merits and sincerity of those who administer and promote the public interests. Though in the pre-war period, certain grave evils tended to infect and corrode the inner strength of the nation, it must be remembered that the other states suffered even more than Germany from these drawbacks, and yet they didn't fail and break down when the time of crisis came. If we remember further that those defects in pre-war Germany were outweighed by great positive qualities, we'll have to look elsewhere for the effective cause of the collapse. And this is actually the case. The ultimate and most profound reason for the German decline is the fact that the racial problem was ignored, and that its importance in the historical development of nations wasn't grasped. Events that take place in the life of nations are not due to chance, but are the natural result of the effort to conserve and multiply the species and the race, even if people aren't conscious of the inner motives of their conduct. So that's a... He's telling you what he's about to get into next. And that's how chapter 10 ends, in discussion of the state of Germany and the role of religion, faith, and dogma. And then next time, chapter 11, is going to start getting into race, which and that'll also be a very long chapter. We'll divide it into parts. Anyway, this has been recording number 14 of Thomas Dalton's translation of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, on archive permanently at vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again for more from Mein Kampf real soon.